After 40 years as a pediatrician, a doctor with a very famous last name has written a very personal memoir.
A love letter to my profession and my patients and how much fun that's been.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, Dr. Mark Vonnegut talks about a life in pediatrics. We'll also spend an academic minute with the importance of prenatal care. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. All right, let's get this part of the story out of the way first. Yes, Dr. Mark Vonnegut is Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s son. And today we're going to talk about a new book that he's written. But this isn't the great American novel. This is the story of Mark's 40 years as a pediatrician. In those years, he has seen massive changes in the American medical system, both good and bad. The name of the book is The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. Dr. Mark Vonnegut is still a practicing pediatrician living in Milton, Massachusetts. I asked why he wrote the book, other than, you know, staying involved in the family business.
It was sort of like a love letter to my profession and my patients and the opportunity I've had to be of service and how much fun that's been. And it's also a love letter to my profession for the opportunity to have taken care of patients for 40 years. I am concerned that younger doctors will not have the same opportunities that I've had, and I'm afraid that patients won't have the same access to medical care that they've had.
Well, you talk about that a lot, how younger doctors today can't, you know, open up their own shop like you were able to.
I was barely able to. I financed it. You remember those credit cards where they give you $50,000 credit free for 6 months or whatever? So it was really a finger-crossing deal where, it was far from certain that I was going to get away with it.
It seems to have worked out for now.
It's been wonderful. I have a wonderful staff. I have an art room. I have a lot of things about reading. Being the boss has advantages.
What in your life brought you to medical school? Because you got there a little later than most people.
I did. I was 6 years off the beaten track. It was the 60s and the uncertainty, and I think we felt we had a duty to try to stop the war, and we thought it was going to be a lot easier than it was. But I think when that was done, I asked myself, well, if it wasn't for that, and I had mental health challenges as well, if it wasn't for all that, what would I have done? I said, well, I was pretty good at math and science. I really, really think I should have been a doctor, and let's see if I can make that happen.
And how about the choice of going into pediatrics?
It's the resilience of children and the fact that you can talk to them about their sneakers. You can talk to them about the shortcomings of their parents. You can talk to them about how unfair teachers are. I mean, these are all great conversations, and they change. I mean, I am now taking care of babies, of the babies I took care of 40 years ago. And that's a great privilege. And I remember telling one mother who was upset with her son who had ADHD that, don't worry, he's just like his father, and that worked out okay. And I think all your son really needs is a wife and a mortgage. He'll be okay.
That kind of settles down the best of us, doesn't it?
It does. And to be able to have conversations like that is it's been wonderful. And I think it's been effective. I think people, kids and parents, listen to me because I've been part of the community for such a long time.
When you went to medical school, what were the expectations of where a doctor ended up when they got out?
Harvard was quite specific. And when I talked about primary care, I was told that with my education, I was supposed to cure generations, not individuals. And that's such a Harvard thing to say. And it was, I'm very, very grateful to Harvard and the education I got. But also when they said that they were going to start concentrating on primary care, I said, oh, please not. Please don't try to go where you have no experience.
Didn't your son ask you how you got into Harvard?
Yes. And I told him that he has the same advantages that I do, is that he writes very well. And I think I had published in the Village Voice and Harper's. So I do think that was different about me. It certainly wasn't my grade point average, as I'm good at multiple choice tests and I write well enough to get published. So that's how I got in.
How about students going into and going through medical school now? Is it a huge change from when you were there, other than, you know, a lot of sciences advanced?
The sciences are pretty much the same. I think what has really changed is what happens once somebody gets into residency, and what they do is they find out that they have to spend a lot of time on screens. I think it was at Bellevue, the average resident spends like 40% of his time with patients, also with a computer. And I don't believe you can get a good history, which is where you get your diagnosis 90% of the time, if you're clicking on a computer at the same time. I just don't think that that's possible, or that it's possible to have time to do a thorough physical exam.
When you are seeing a patient, a youngster, are you treating the parent as much as you're treating the kid?
Absolutely. You come to moments, I call them judo moments, where parents come in with a certain view of their child, and you use their own momentum to flip them. And you say something like, oh, I understand. You have this expectation, or I understand you think that you're normal and you want your child to behave a certain way, and your child's going to be fine and you're going to be fine. You should just relax and enjoy the differences.
Has treating kids changed much over the 40 years?
It shouldn't have as much as it has. You know, and I think there should be a commitment. The other thing I think that's different about medical care now is I have seen people before and I see them now and I'm going to see them again. And as I say often, rather than lab tests or x-rays, time is my best diagnostic tool. Calling patients and seeing how they're doing. And giving people the time, like to talk them out of antibiotics I don't think they really need, talk them out of x-rays I don't think they really need, and just sort of say, this is my expectation. If it doesn't happen, you know, we're not going to let this go on and on forever.
Do you miss making house calls?
I do. It was, and it is, and some of my nurse practitioners still do it. If you have a mother who has just given birth and you ask somebody who's had this major physiologic change in her life to get her act together, get the baby dressed, and come to my office, it's unreasonable. Hospitals used to keep babies long enough that they knew the baby was thriving, was starting to gain a little weight. But I like being a hero with four-wheel drive and a blizzard coming to somebody's house too. And I bring a scale and a stethoscope and measuring things. That's fun.
There are quite a few characters other than yourself in this book, and a few of them I'd like to highlight. First of all, tell us about Dr. Dan, because I would love to have met Dr. Dan.
Dr. Dan was so wonderful, and the lesson was that what his patients cared about was his incredible attention. He also rode a bike everywhere when it wasn't snowing, but he would come into a room in November or December in the middle of horrible weather, and he had shorts on, and he wore a beanie. And it was just the fact that that meant nothing to his parents and patients, who knew and could sense the incomplete attention he paid to his patients. So I got to be an attending in the emergency room, and I learned a lot from him about you don't need an X-ray. You do not need a blood test. What you have to do is look at the parents, listen to the story, do a physical exam. And that was in the days before computers, and that's how you figured out what was going on.
I think you buried the lead that the beanie had a propeller on it.
Yeah, I did. I did. You know why I did that? I think when I tell people the story about Dan, they don't believe that. But it was true.
I want to talk also about some of the kids that you talked about in the book, some hilarious and some tragic. And I'm going to go for hilarious first because I want to lighten it up. Tell me about Polly and her eye.
Polly was a beautiful baby who happened to be born without a left eye. And for many reasons, the best thing to do for Polly was to remove the sick eye and give her a glass eye. And Polly learned very early, and I wish all kids could sort of fend off the little old ladies who are going to come up and tell the parents how to raise the child. So the little old lady would get close and say, coochie, coochie, goo, or whatever. And Polly would pop out her eye and show it to the little old lady, who not all of them fainted, but it was certainly not the smiling, happy response they were expecting.
You end that chapter with Polly is a genius, and I agree. Another patient you treated was a young man named Frankie who would throw up in inopportune times.
Right. And his mother was very concerned with the fact that once or twice a week, Frankie would throw up, and she wanted to know why. Frankie was about 12. And I said, okay, is there any fever? Is there any diarrhea? Frankie looked perfectly healthy. And I say, well, Frankie, what do you think is going on? He said, it's every time my mother feeds me eggplant. Eggplant is slimy. And the mother clearly she had heard this before. And she said, nobody's allergic to eggplant. And I said, that might be, but let's let science do its job here and have Frankie not eat eggplant for 2 weeks and see if the vomiting goes away. And guess what? No more vomiting.
It's the best medical intervention ever.
And that's been the opportunity. And I think when a doctor sees a patient once and hasn't seen them before and isn't going to see them again, they don't have that opportunity. They don't have time. They don't have follow-up. And I think a lot gets missed.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Mark Vonnegut continues with his memories of working with poor children in Honduras. And yes, after that, we do talk a bit about his famous father. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Mark Vonnegut. We're talking about his new book called The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. In the book, Dr. Vonnegut talks about traveling to developing countries to help give children their medical care. I ask how important those trips were to him and other young doctors.
They're certainly invaluable to me. I mean, you see how most of the world lives. And it was shocking to me, and it was shocking to Americans to see the sort of poverty in which most people live, to see that people will walk however many miles to see the Yankee doctor. And it wasn't that we had great cures. It was just to have the Yankee doctor care about them and for them, had very few resources. I was there with my hands and my eyes and my stethoscope, and I would sometimes say, this child needs to see an endocrinologist or this or that, and I was reassured I was told that would happen, but it was also just being on my own and loving it. I loved not having people tell me what to do. And part of what I think the new generation of doctors has too much of is people telling them what to do. And what I was able to do in Honduras, can often do now, is say, if I need help, I'll ask you for help. Don't start helping me before I ask.
Obvious from the book, many times you have no love for the current insurance situation that you need to work with. It seems like insurance, which was the way you describe it in the book, was meant to help pay for medical care. And actually, it's the main reason medical care costs so much now.
It was definitely, it started as a way for people to, for very small amounts of money, to sort of prepay the possibility that they would need hospital care. It was great for hospitals. It was great for patients. When I was in medical school, there a fair amount of insurance money went to education, went to research. They were not for-profit organizations. And the fact that they, and pharmaceutical industry is the same issue exactly, there has been an increasing conflict between the money of medical care and the mission of medical care. And I fear that will get worse, and the patients, again, they will get help that they're not asking for. They will be told what to do. They will be told that they have to do prior authorizations and these things that were designed to give us less but better medical care. I literally have to write letters to insurance companies for paralyzed kids to get wheelchairs. Children do not, or their parents, don't fake the need for wheelchairs. They stopped after a few years, but I had to write a letter that said, Maggie still has no left leg. Could you please allow her to see an orthopedist? And all that cost much more than the phone call I used to make to the orthopedist. And kids, when I made a call to a specialist, they were usually seen within a few days. And now it's all done through the medical record. I don't want to get tedious here, but I used to be able to call up a psychiatrist. You can't not see a pediatric psychiatrist because they don't exist. There's a waiting list for 6 months. So if you have a suicidal child, you try to explain that the child doesn't want to kill themselves in 6 months. They want to kill themselves now. And that's a very serious and tragic situation, which has led to a crisis in mental health care.
Well, speaking of mental health care, and you're very open about your experiences with that, should it be talked about much more? Should it be more normalized?
There should be more opportunities for care. There should be more therapists. You should not get letters back from insurance say, we have more than enough therapists there. We do not want to approve of this new therapist. It sort of shocks me. Again, they want less but better care, and the way they reimburse, what we get is less care. The better gets forgotten.
You talked about early in the book about vaccines. You were alive, of course, when the polio vaccine was first approved, and it was, you know, you lined up in school and you got your vaccines. My favorite line in that whole chapter was school nurses take less crap. So should school, what is the job of a school nurse these days?
I mean, the possibility of vaccine refusal, I think it shouldn't be there. And I often will sit, because I think it's part of my job, to try to talk parents into vaccines. But I think it, for a lot of people, it becomes part of their identity that they're healthy, their kids are healthy, they don't need vaccines. I think when I was growing up, I don't think there was an option. And at the school, once they got you into the gymnasium, you weren't getting out of there without a polio shot. And I honestly think that the enforcement and the teeth of this should not be with me, because I do not believe in denying kids medical care just because their parents have nutty ideas.
I think it's most of these parents have never seen these diseases, so it's just a concept to them instead of something they've seen. They haven't seen measles. They haven't seen polio.
Recent immigrants, they say, what else do you have? I mean, they have come from situations where they see very serious infectious diseases, and there's no vaccine refusal there. They really want to know what else you have.
You're very open about doctors can be wrong. And one of the chapters in that, you told the story of a girl named Adeline. Could you tell us her story?
Well, she was born with an extra chromosome. It wasn't 21, which gives you Down syndrome. It was a much more serious situation where she had multiple issues. And the teaching was that these kids couldn't survive a year. And Adeline proved people wrong over and over and over. And one of the best events of my life was, going to her 16th birthday, where she and her friends were riding on a horse, and my wife and I were there celebrating this girl who wasn't supposed to live a year. We got to see her 16th birthday. We had decisions about, do we immunize her? And I said, well, probably not, because the pain of the shots, and she's not going to run into any of these things. She's not going to go to school. Then her mother called me and she says, well, she's playing in the dirt with her siblings. And I said, okay, well, we'll start immunizing her. I got a call from the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which does wonderful work, and said, well, I mean, Adeline was blind and she was deaf. Should we send Adeline to Disneyland? Would she be able to appreciate it? And I said, she would probably not notice much, but her siblings would get a great deal out of it. And I think in this case, you're treating a whole family. And two of her siblings, went on to be in medical care. So the whole story, had I been just saying, okay, she has this problem, shall we fix it? I would have missed a lot. But because I've been in the community and taking care of these other kids and stuff, I got to take care of the whole family.
And you do tell the story about your father's passing in the book. Does being a doctor make that more difficult because you want to get in there and fix it?
It's what made it more difficult is the other doctors treating me as if I was different and treating him different. And they started calling him a cultural icon. And it was just such a, I think fame is a horrible thing to do to somebody. I really do. I think it was bad for him. I think it was bad for the family. And they basically ignored his living will. They ignored the fact that I was his medical proxy and stuff, basically because he was a cultural icon. And I just think is so much more complicated than that, who he was. And nobody wanted to be responsible for the death of a cultural icon.
I love the story you told when you were on stage with him at one time and someone asked a question to Mr. Vonnegut and he turned to you for you to answer. And he said, "No, I'm Dr. Vonnegut."
Man, that was so much fun.
After 40 years, Dr. Mark Vonnegut is still a practicing pediatrician in Milton, Massachusetts. His new book is called The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. It should be published in February. So as we heard, Dr. Vonnegut was a graduate of Harvard Medical School. So where do you think we should go for today's academic minute?
Quantity doesn't always mean quality when it comes to prenatal care. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Neil Shaw, assistant professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School, explains how many visits are needed.
It should go without saying that prenatal care, or healthcare for pregnant people, is important. But our understanding of what makes prenatal care high quality has historically been limited to a single metric: how many times a person visits their doctor. Typically, the number of recommended visits is around 12 to 14 over the 9 months of pregnancy, a highly regimented model that has not meaningfully changed since it was introduced in the 1930s. In a new study that I co-authored with my colleagues Rebecca Gorovich, Tanya Natwick, Christine Chasen, and Amber Weiseth, we sought to identify another measure: what actually happens when you make all those visits to your doctor. We did this by identifying 8 common services that are universally recommended by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Those include getting tested for infections, receiving the Tdap vaccine, being screened for gestational diabetes. What we found is this: patients with at least 4 prenatal visits received, on average, 6 of the guideline-recommended services. For those patients who made additional visits, guideline-based care did not increase. In other words, going to the doctor more did not lead to patients receiving more clinically recommended care. We also found notable inequities. For instance, rates of Tdap vaccination were lower in counties with higher proportions of minority residents, lower education, and lower income. In the wake of the pandemic, there's been increased attention to how we deliver prenatal care in the United States. As we consider how to best adapt this model to the 21st century, it'll be important to think about what quality really means. It's clear from our study that FaceTime alone cannot be the sole measure of quality for pregnant people.
That was Neil Shaw of Harvard Medical School. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.